Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Trib hockey writers Jason Mackey and Jonathan Bombulli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Want to go, pretty boy? Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're going to play some friggin' all-time hockey!
Western Canadian feel to this one. It's the Friday edition of the Penguins Roundtable here on November the 6th. Jonathan Bombulli is along. I'm Ken Laird, and we'll be checking in with Jason Mackey, Intrepid reporter, Trib Live Radio, and Trib Total Media, Penguins beat reporter, who's out at Rexall Place in Edmonton right now. Jonathan, you went to Toronto, but you didn't get the Western trip, eh?
No, I did the Toronto, I did the Washington last week, I did a little bit of Wilkes-Barre this week, but no, not the Vancouver-Edmonton-Calgary swing.
All right, well, much to get to in terms, including your trip to your old stomps there in Wilkes-Barre, but... Just in general, only one game this week. Let's overview the Penguins here, Jonathan. They've won 7 of 8, and they win 3-2 at Vancouver after a 3-0 lead that got interesting at the end, but still, impressive to start the trip with a nice road win, and if you look at the standings, and things look a whole lot better than they did at 0-3.
But isn't that the truth? I mean, and you look at the standings, and there's like a couple of teams that seem to be establishing themselves, Montreal and... the Rangers and maybe Washington. And other than that, it seems like it's a, you know, you can put everybody else in a bag. But that group in a bag, the Penguins are at the front of it right now. I think that Vancouver game was a really good sort of indication of what you've been seeing lately, which is, you know, just a little bit of contributions here and there. A little bit of Perron, he's starting to, you know, come around. A little bit of Crosby, he's starting to come around. And a little bit of Eric Fair, who's been great since he came back. Great goaltending by Fleury in the second period, and you get a one-goal win. And, I mean, that's kind of how it's been going. And, we complained about it for a long time. But now it's been such a sustained stretch over so many weeks, I don't think anybody's complaining about it anymore. I mean, it's just, you know, low-scoring one-goal games, and you win them, and on to the next one.
Yeah, winning is fun. I mean, listen, we still complain about the style and the lack of offense. And Rob Rossi was on earlier, and he called the game unwatchable. Some people would agree. Some people still love it. And there are some high-scoring games in the league. It just doesn't happen to be this team, Jonathan, who is the best defensive team in the league. I mean, are you shocked by this, or do we think this may change, or is this the whole year? Is this their DNA? They're going to win games 3-2 and 2-1.
I've been thinking about this, and you know, people talk about Mike Johnston's system and how it is actually a defensive system. I don't believe that. What I believe is that the unintended consequences of Mike Johnston's system have turned the Penguins into a really good defensive team. It's like a happy accident. The idea was, you know, you're going to get four guys. They're going to leave the defensive zone with the puck together in a pack, and it's going to be great. It's going to look like, you know, Finland in the World Championships. And what ends up happening is instead of them, you know, four guys attacking in a group of four, when the puck gets turned over, you all of a sudden you have four guys behind the puck. That you could count the number of odd man rushes this team has given up, even strength, on one hand. So. And that isn't necessarily the plan, but it's just worked out that way. So you end up with this sort of unintended consequence where you're never giving up odd man rushes, and the way Fleury's playing, you're just not going to give up a lot of goals that way. It's weird, is it sustainable? I think it is, because you have guys in that system who, while they weren't necessarily designed to be, you know, defensive players, are actually pretty good at it. Malkin being the number one example of a guy who, when you put him in that spot, you know, he's just fundamentally, I mean, with his skill and with his size and with his temperament, is a really good defensive player. Crosby's always been a good defensive player. So you're just kind of accidentally becoming a defensive juggernaut, which is, you're right, it's totally weird. But I think it is sustainable.
Now, there were some odd man rushes that Vancouver had early in the second period of that game. Dumoulin got beat. Horvat had a chance.
Yeah,
Came in on a breakaway, hit the post. There were few and far between, but there was a stretch there. And at that time, I'm thinking to myself, Jonathan, this is what the coach is afraid of. If he opens it up too much, he's afraid of his defense getting beat.
Well, and those were, I mean, the Dumoulin play, for instance, was on a line change. So, like, there's, you know, there's obviously circumstances when there's sort outs and when things get a little bit chaotic, you are going to have those odd man rushes. And you're right. I mean, I don't think they would want to you know, change the style too much, because then you'd put those defensemen out on an island, and it you know, personnel wise, it's not the strength of the team. You don't want to do that. But in the role that you have them in, I mean, Dumoulin and Lovejoy have been great. They've like really exceeded expectations, in the last couple of weeks. So, I'd be very hesitant to change anything if I was running this team. You know, I understand that you don't want to be winning games 2-1 and 3-2. That's not how you were built, but. You know, there's that thing about fixing things that aren't broken.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you got to give Johnston credit for getting wins. See, right now they're tied with the Rangers and the Capitals in games played, and they're 2 points behind them. They have two games in hand on the Islanders, who are 1 point ahead of them, so they're very much in the mix. And, you know, it's tough to clinch things this early in the NHL, but if you're 8 to 10 points back right now, you might be out of it.
Yeah.
It might have been devastating. So he has saved their season from that point of view, hasn't he?
I mean, I don't know if any... Like, for a while, I thought Fleury was saving the season. But now, the more I look at it, I think it's more of a, you know, team concept. I mean, especially because the one game Jeff Zatkoff played, he made 50 saves. So,
true.
You know, that sort of lends me to believe that, yeah, goaltending's a part of it. But it's a 20-man effort. It's in, you know, and the idea is playing solid fundamental hockey and scoring goals when you can. And it's not pretty. I agree with Rossi 1,000% on that. It is not pretty. And it's not necessarily wildly entertaining, but it's, and we keep coming back to the same thing. It's working.
Well, one thing that's really working is Evgeny Malkin right now.
Absolutely.
And he's rising above this hockey, which has become a grind at times. And, you know, some people have called militaristic or too disciplined, but that Gino Kessel line with Perron now has been good. So the question is, why are they succeeding in this system and producing offensive chances when the Crosby line has not? And is it the Kessel effect? You know, is it just if Kessel had stayed with Sid, that would have been the better line of the two?
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, just because the Malkin-Kessel pairing has been pretty good, so I didn't think, you know, what would have happened if they would have stayed together. I feel like there have been a couple of stretches where the Crosby-Hornquist combination has been really good. That Buffalo game, for instance, they were awesome together.
There was a lot of talking on the bench in the Vancouver game. They kept showing shots of them over there, discussing, like, he and Hornquist talking, Dupuis talking with him, Kunitz is up. They're all it's like they can't figure things out, or they're going through schematics in their brain to try to figure out why they can't get some good chances.
Yeah, I noticed that in Toronto, too, that Crosby and Hornquist were having a long talk on the ice during a timeout. So, yeah, I mean, there's lots of evidence that they're still figuring things out. And I don't think Malkin and Kessel, I don't think they do as much thinking.
No.
I don't mean that as an insult. It's just they're more instinctive players. And they tend to, you know, dart into holes and find spots. And to me, Perron getting his act together is a huge factor with those
sure.
two as well. Because he's the last couple of games, he's been real good in terms of sort of understanding what he needs to do with those two guys. Because there are times where he gets a little too... he handles the puck too much, and he gets a little bit, you know, too much like he's the star of the show, which he's not with those two guys anyway. And so when he starts to find that chemistry, I mean, this is the thing. This is the luxury you have when you figured out a defensive system that works. You have time to let Crosby and Hornquist and Dupuis sort of get things together. You have time to let Perron, you know, get his head out of his butt. You have time for Malkin and Kessel to develop chemistry. When you're not giving up a lot of goals, there's just not that urgency. You don't, you know, hey, don't worry about it, you'll get them next time, Tiger. So, and that's it's not expected, but there it is.
Ken Laird and Jonathan Bombouli here in studio, and on the road is Jason Mackey, Penguins beat reporter for Trip Total Media. He checks in with us from Rexall Place. I think we got Jay on the line. Jason, you got us loud and clear?
Guys? I'm here.
What's going on? What we're just discussing, the Gino line versus the Crosby line. What's led to one line looking a lot better than the other?
Yeah, I go back to even before this season started and they decided to pair Crosby and Kessel together. I don't think that pairing with their styles works as well as the Malkin and Kessel pairing. And I think we're just seeing that. You know, I think there's some truth to what Jonathan said about their more instinctive players and even just style of play. You know, Crosby's a straight line player. He likes predictability, and Patrick Hornquist is a hard-nosed guy who you know is going to be in front of the net. So, to me, they don't have it completely figured out yet, Crosby and Hornquist, but I think they will. They were really good for the better part of last year, and their games mesh. Malkin and Kessel, man, they've been fun to watch. It was fun to talk to Malkin about Kessel and Kessel about Malkin yesterday. I have yet, this was the first time I saw Phil Kessel really get engaged in how he answers a question. Like, he stopped taking off his equipment and was describing how Malkin, you know, kind of gets into a gallop and uses his speed and how the shoulders move and everything. I really, really, really believe that he enjoys playing with Evgeny Malkin. And I think we're only seeing sort of the surface being scratched of that pairing.
Well, you know, what we were hearing a lot this week on our show, guys, is the call now for Eric Fehr, who's had a couple shorthanded goals, to be playing with Sid and Hornqvist to spark that line. Is it a total overreaction, or is there a possibility somewhere down the road, Jason, Fehr could get bumped up to the top two lines?
Yeah, I don't think that's crazy to think that Fehr could get top 6 minutes. I mean, this is a guy that came up, you know, throughout most of his career as a scorer. I believe he's a first-round pick. If not, it's a high second, but I believe it's a first. And, you know, the guy can score. He can play on the wing. He can do a lot of different things. So, yeah, if something falters, I don't think they have any hesitancy at all about putting Eric Fehr in that situation. But David Perron's been really good. He's been assertive. He's played the role that he should play on that line. And I don't think Pascal Dupuis has been the problem on that top line. To be honest with you, I don't even think there's been a problem on that top line. I think some people are overreacting. They think Crosby should score 4 goals a game. But, you know, those guys have just kind of settled back in, and it will come. But I don't see how removing Dupuis, if he's healthy, would be any sort of benefit. You know, Eric Fehr is giving them some really, really timely goals in situations, in lines. You know, I was looking at the bottom six of the Flames versus the bottom six of the Penguins, and I knew the Penguins would come out on top, but, I mean, it's laughable, the advantage right now that the Penguins have with their bottom six forwards and the matchups they're going to get. I mean, it is a really, really good group. When they're healthy, they're playing well together. We're talking about, you know, Plotnikov or Strong. Jeez, I mean, that is a bit part. This is a deep group, and the Penguins can really gain an advantage by having Eric Fehr in their bottom six.
I would argue that because of what Jason was just talking about, it doesn't much matter. Getting that promotion to the top six isn't the golden ticket that it used to be. I mean, it used to be if you left a guy who was scoring in the bottom six, you were like missing out on an opportunity to get him in scoring situations. With the fact that the top line, you know, the Crosby-Hornqvist pairing haven't really lit it up, and the fact that the bottom six have been really good, like, they're all getting closer together. I mean, this is getting more to that four-line concept than it's ever been before around here. I mean, and so when you're talking about even strength ice time, I think if that bottom six stays together, I think it's going to start to get, you know, five-on-five, it's going to start to really even out. So it's really not going to matter a whole lot of what, you know, which line Fehr's playing on, because he's playing with good players no matter what.
Well, Crosby,
and
Jason,
as we've seen too, when Crosby's playing 18, 20 minutes a game, he's better than when he's playing 24. You know, I don't think they benefit when they overplay Crosby and Malkin, and having productive bottom six forwards will allow them to keep their minutes in a manageable range. Yeah.
Well, I was watching the Vancouver telecast, Jason, and between periods on Sportsnet after the second and third, they were talking about Sid, and he was on the verge of 10 games out of 12 without a point. And, like, maybe we are overreacting, but if we're overreacting, so is Canada. So you're up there, and what kind of a story has that been, Sid's production? I know he did score the power play goal there in the 4-on-3, but what kind of talking point has that been up there?
Yeah, I mean, it's been the talking point. But I don't think, you know, unless Sidney Crosby is just scoring out of his mind and they're asking him questions about scoring out of his mind, he's not scoring enough. You know, it's kind of funny how much the players inside the dressing room laugh at members of the media for asking about Crosby scoring. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. I mean, we should be asking the question. There are metrics that don't match up with his career numbers, and I'm not saying it's not a story. But it is a major talking point here. You know, it is the number one issue with the Penguins right now. Number one is, you know, why Sid not scoring? 1A is why are the Penguins not scoring? And probably number two is Marc-Andre Fleury. But it is absolutely a hot-button topic. I just don't think it's as cataclysmic as, you know, you might figure out by watching a Canadian TV station or something. It's just, you know, I don't think the Kessel pairing worked out. They went away from it. It's been better. I think Crosby and Hornqvist are going to produce together, and I think Crosby's done a lot of things to help his team win games. And when he is shooting, and I've said this, I think, 9,000 times, when he's shooting and being assertive, he's fantastic and has been fantastic this season. He just needs to find a way to do that more consistently.
It's Peds Roundtable here on Trib Live Radio. What are you seeing from the morning skate? I guess the Oilers were just on the ice, Jason, and the Penguins set to get out there soon?
Yeah, we're kind of in that dead zone in between skates. I wouldn't be surprised if this is an optional for the Penguins, honestly. They went pretty hard yesterday in practice. This is the, you know, that was quote-unquote the day off with three games and four nights. They got back-to-backs here. I wouldn't be surprised to see them rest some veterans. But, yeah, ice cut right now. Not too much going on with the Oilers. Jordan Eberle comes back tonight. Nilsson was the first goalie off. He's probably going to start. But that's about it. You know, it's kind of a topic of conversation. The guy that isn't with the Oilers right now, Connor McDavid, everybody in the Penguins room and then the Oilers room, they wanted to see him matched up against Crosby. So it's just kind of this gigantic bummer that it's not happening. But, you know, should be a good hockey game. The Oilers are actually a surprisingly decent team.
Well, Jonathan, you were in Wilkes-Barre a bit this week, and I don't know if you were there for the Derek Pouliot stuff, but I know Jason just talked to Jim Rutherford about him as well. But let's talk about Pouliot and that story, the public drunkenness issue, and what'd you find out in Wilkes-Barre? What was the theme out there, JB?
Well, I don't want to, I don't want to brag or anything, but I'm the reason there is Derek Pouliot stuff.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know.
No, I went down there Wednesday just to kind of, you know, talk to Pouliot and you know, talk to a couple other prospects, Dominic Simone and a couple guys, and then Pouliot wasn't at morning skate. And then he didn't play in the game that night, and so that makes you ask a couple questions, and one thing leads to another, and then I'm getting the police report from the Wilkes-Barre police. So, yeah, I don't want to. I want to make this clear because this is something that, you know, people have asked about. Do I think this is a big deal with him? No, of course not. I mean, he's a 21-year-old kid was drunk after a Halloween party. Big deal. But I do think, you know, when it's a news story, I mean, you know, when a professional athlete has a brush with the law, we sort of cover it. I don't think it's going to have a negative impact on him long term. I think the fact that he was taking a cab and not driving is a mark in his favor. I think he learned, don't get drunk and argue with cab drivers, which is, you know, probably a good rule to learn by in your early 20s. So I don't think it's a big deal, but you know, it's a thing. It's a little bit of a thing for him. And considering that his progress has been slowed in terms of getting to the NHL as a regular, it's just another sort of talking point on that same train. But, you know, like Jason talked to Jim Rutherford, and they're not viewing it as any kind of major setback for him, and I don't think I would either.
What do you think, Jason?
I think the only reason we're talking about this as much as we are, because, I mean, exactly what JB said. I mean, he's drunk after a Halloween party. No kidding. Wow. None of us were drunk after a Halloween party when we were 21. But I think it's a little bit bigger deal because of sort of the challenge they issued Derek Pouliot this summer. You know, they made him come to development camp, for crying out loud. They made him go to London, Ontario. I mean, this is a guy that played, what, 34 NHL games last season. He should be worrying about being in the NHL and doing things to stay there. And they kind of, you know, challenged him to be more consistent, to grow up a lot. And, you know, maybe this says he hasn't done that. I don't buy that argument, but I just, you know, I think that's the only reason that this is even being talked about too, is, I mean, you know, he's going to get suspended. You have to report it. I get that. But, you know, if this were Tom Kunackle, it would be buried in the bottom of a notebook. It's just because it's Derek Pouliot.
Did he indeed fail to pay the cab fare? Is that what started it?
All right, this is like sort of, I don't know that I have this to the point where I could, you know, necessarily put my name on it and write it, but just me and you talking, nobody listening here, Ken, I'll tell you what I know.
Yeah, nobody's listening.
All right, good. He gets the cab driver, English was not his first language, as is sometimes the case with cab drivers. So they get to their destination, and all Pouliot has is 100. And he asks the cab driver if the cab driver has change for the 100. He doesn't understand what the cab driver said. So you get into this situation where Pouliot doesn't want to give the cab driver the 100 because he doesn't think he's going to get change. And the cab driver thinks he's getting stiffed on his fare. And one of the two parties doesn't speak English all that well, and the other one is extraordinarily drunk. So you can see how a meeting of the minds did not occur. So that's the nature of the dispute, and then the police got involved. Nothing physical, just an argument on a street corner, and that's pretty much, it's a miscommunication as much as anything. But I think
he was drunk. They Right, that's prove that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to the point where when the cops showed up, they didn't just shake his hand and send him on his way. They took him to the station and until a. I love the way the police report said he was released to a sober adult.
Well, he is 21. I mean, Jason, what did Rutherford say about it when you chatted with the Pens GM?
They want to make sure it's a one-off. I mean, if there's a pattern here, which I don't think anybody thinks there is, then, you know, there's going to be an issue. But, you know, I think Jim called it an unfortunate incident or an unfortunate happening, something like that. I mean, they're not trying to make light of the fact that he was drinking and had a brush with the law. But they're trying to keep it in perspective that, like JB said, he wasn't driving, you know, he wasn't beating someone up. He wasn't, you know, this wasn't that big of a deal. We're not trying to blow it out of proportion. It's just, I think it's a little bit of a lesson learned for a 21-year-old kid. I mean, carry a credit card, be able to use said credit card. Or what happened to Uber? What are you doing?
I don't know how Uber's penetration in Wilkes-Barre at this point.
Yeah, it is Wilkes-Barre. And let's be honest, your chances for public drunkenness go way up when you get sent to Wilkes-Barre. So, I mean, let's give the kid a break.
There's Uber in Newark. There has to be Uber in Wilkes-Barre.
I would think so. He's still a couple public drunkenness citations off of Ryan Stone's team record.
Which is what? How many we got?
Two or three, I'm not sure. Okay. That was one of his specialties. One of my favorite Ryan Stone public drunkenness citations was he was at a bar and he was sitting on a stool outside the bar checking IDs. Like he didn't work there, he was just a customer.
Let's see your ID.
Yeah, so he just carded everyone coming in and he was just a customer who had a little bit too much to drink. The cops didn't care for that very much.
That's
good. Good guy, that Ryan Stone. He just, you know, he liked to party a little bit.
Well, we talk about him, but I mean, he is a big time prospect, Jason, right? I mean, and if he's coming up soon, he could spark this power play. He could spark the offense from the back end. I mean, it could be a big deal if he's ready to go when he comes up here.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't diminish the return of Derek Pouliot and what he would mean to this team. Right now, Chris Letang has not set the world on fire, really in all aspects, but specifically on the power play. They could use somebody to come in and run the point. I don't think Derek Pouliot's going to eat up, you know, 25 minutes of even strength time, but he could come in there and run that top power play, and I think it would be beneficial. He is the organization's second-best prospect. Let's trace back to the summer, too, the Phil Kessel deal. Jim Rutherford wasn't parting with him. He wasn't giving up Olimata. He wasn't giving up Derek Pouliot. He would give up anybody else. That's the way this kid is thought of, and for good reason. You know, he's got all the talent in the world. The mistakes he made last year, I mean, you talk about stuff that is correctable and stuff you can coach. I mean, they are coachable mistakes. It was just, you know, thinking a little bit more, being a little bit smarter with your first pass. The kid has all the upside in the world. It's just, you know, having to nail down a little bit of maturity, I guess.
Yeah, and from that point of view, you know, you wonder, like, Letang, why is he looking so average? Yet again, love Julian Dumoulin looking good. I go back to Jonathan, what we talked about last week. It's like in this system, Letang's become a $7 million shot blocker. But maybe that means Pouliot could come up and he could actually be like Dumoulin and Lovejoy and look pretty good.
It's possible. I mean, to me, the focus with Letang, I think he's away from the puck. I think he's been fine. I think it's that, like Jason was saying, you want to see something out of him on that power play. Like you realize, when you watch Letang in that spot, you realize why they invited Sergei Gonchar to training camp, even though he was obviously, you know, had very little left, because he can do all the things on the power play that Letang cannot, in terms of, you know, just making smart plays with the puck. And so I don't know. I don't, you know, and that's really not, I mean, Letang has never really been that crafty guy on the power play. He's been the guy who, you know, succeeds because he's explosive and because he's, you know, got a good shot and because he gets the puck to the guys who make plays. So, like, you know, could you, I don't know what plan B is in terms of that point guy on that, you know, on that first power play unit. I don't know that there is one. But if there is a plan B, I would think Pouliot's part of it. But I'll tell you this. I don't know who I'd take out to put Pouliot in right now. I mean, everybody's going to say Rob Scuderi, but Rob Scuderi's he's been fine. He's been a plus five. He's been a good influence on Olimata. I wouldn't be in a, like, I understand you want to get Adam Clendenning in. So maybe a rotation would be good with Scuderi, but I wouldn't be in like a huge hurry to get him out of the lineup right now. So it's not as easy as just, you know, call the kid up and get him out there. There's decisions that have to be made.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Jason? Where would he play if he comes up and goes in? He's a left-handed shot, which makes you think Dumoulin would be the guy that would go out, right?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I don't think they want Rob Scuderi to play, you know, down to 81 games. In fact, I know they don't want him to play every game. So you could give him a break here and there, but you also don't call up Derek Pouliot to have him play sparingly. I mean, Ben Lovejoy is a guy you could jump in and out of the lineup. Brian Dumoulin, I feel like, has played well enough to earn his spot. If you look at somebody objectively, you'd probably take Ian Cole out of the lineup the way he played against Vancouver. It was not good. You don't remove Chris Letang. And, you know, Rob Scuderi, you could give him a night off here and there. But you're not going to sit $3.375 million in the press box. It just doesn't make financial sense. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's kind of a tough spot. They could have sort of a carousel of defensemen. I know this sounds insane, but you could maybe trade one of them. You know, if Scuderi is expendable at this point, if he's playing well and you could get a seventh-round pick for him right now, it's not the worst idea in the world. Ben Lovejoy's been really good right now. Maybe ship him out for some prospects or a draft pick. I mean, we know that the Penguins are light on that, and, you know, if the stock's high, sell. Even Brian Dumoulin, you know, you probably hate to see the kid go. I think he's certainly maturing, but Derek Pouliot is your blue line anchor. He was the defenseman you did not want to give up on. So maybe you ship him out for some prospects. I'm not sure, but this stuff does have a way of working out. I think if they buy their time, I mean, you know the Penguins are going to suffer injuries. That much is pretty much guaranteed. So you have depth when they happen.
That's absolutely – and also, it's not going to hurt Pouliot to sit in the minors and work on his defensive game, because his defensive game is not all that hot. So,
right.
You know, it's not a bad thing. He's not dying on the vine. He's actually still learning things.
What about Daniel Sprong? Get an update on that in your latest notebook, Jay.
Yeah, basically that the Penguins don't care about him sitting. They don't feel like he has to play every game. And I'll use this analogy, and these are my words, but junior hockey would be worse for this kid's development than being scratched. And I think that's the argument that you need to kind of look at this with. By working with people one-on-one after practice the way, or after morning skate the way he did in Vancouver, the Penguins feel like he's developing and he's being challenged and he's learning, and they want to get him into games. I mean, there's just no way you can healthy scratch him all the time and then expect him to develop. But until things kind of shake out, you know, there's a variable with Sergei Plotnikov, there's variables with Pascal Dupuis and Bo Bennett. Yeah, they're carrying one forward too many that should probably be playing in the game, but there's a reason for that, and they don't feel like it's harming his development. And that comes from a conversation with Jim Rutherford yesterday. And I just went up to Jim and I asked him, you know, if he's okay with Daniel Sprong being healthy scratch, because it seemed like Rutherford loved Daniel Sprong and Mike Johnson wasn't using him as much as Rutherford seemed to love him. And yeah, I mean, there's nothing there. They're happy with, they're fine with him sitting as long as he's learning and developing.
Well, we get the sounds of sticks and pucks in the background, so I'm assuming that's the Penguins on the ice, Jason. Before we let you go,
I should probably go do my work.
Yeah, but can you give us a little scene set? What have you done in Edmonton, Alberta? Anything?
Nothing. I got in. I got in late last night from Vancouver about 11 o'clock. Went across the street, had a burger, came back to my hotel, and went to sleep. I got up this morning. I had breakfast. I researched this game, filed an early story, and we're here. The exciting life of a beat reporter.
Okay. Well, take an Uber. Use your own advice. We don't want to hear any Pouliot stories. All right.
That sounds good, guys. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right, see you later. Jason Mackey up in Edmonton. Was looking on Yelp for the highest-rated thing in Edmonton.
Okay.
It's a place called Woodwork, downtown, cocktail bar. So
that sounds nice.
I'm going to go with Woodwork tonight for Jason Mackey.
All right. I'd look for somewhere warm. It's probably snowing there already.
Maybe it is. I have no idea. We'll take a quick pause here in the Pens Roundtable. Coming up, more from Jonathan Bombulli on the state of the Pens, including, well, I mean, there's a lot of changes in terms of Mike Babcock speaking about the state of the game. I want to get your take on this, Jonathan, whether the net should be widened, and Crosby and Fleury responding to that, and talk about the Olympics and the NHL's participation in it coming up, and maybe changing the All-Star Game format. So some of those ancillary events, and we'll preview Edmonton and Calgary a little bit in the rest of this trip. It's the Pens Roundtable every Friday from 1 to 2 here on Trib Live Radio.
You don't need to face criminal charges alone. Call me, Frank Walker, 412-532-6805.
Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Trib hockey writers Jason Mackey and Jonathan Bombouli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Want to go, pretty boy? Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're going to play some friggin' all-time hockey!
Jonathan Bombouli in studio. I'm Ken Laird and Jason Mackey on the road. We just checked in with Jason at Rexall Place, where the skate is optional this morning for the Penguins, so they're taking it easy out there, my friend. No Mike Johnston on the ice either, so they're in a good spot here. They don't need to grind anybody to a nub, and they do play back-to-back games, Jonathan, so I guess that's no big surprise. They're going to take the load off a little bit here.
I've actually noticed that, just something I've noticed just, you know, covering this team closely for the first time, that Johnston does tend to do fewer optional practices, and more optional morning skates. Like John Hines, just to do by comparison, he would never have an optional morning skate. But if there was a game, you know, if they played Wednesday, Friday, that Thursday practice would be optional. So it's just kind of like little coaches, different coaches have different little quirks that they like to do, and Johnston does that optional morning skate thing more than most coaches.
I wonder what Johnston's rationale is. What I wonder why he does that. Does he feel like some guys don't need it, some do, and just leave it up to them?
I don't know, but I question the whole rationale of morning skate in the first place. I'm sort of on that Joe Maddon thing. You know how Joe Maddon, like, canceled batting practice, basically, for the second half of the season? Told his guys to just, you know, come in a little bit later. I don't know, the whole morning skate thing, I think it seems kind of antiquated. I've told the guys this in the newsroom before, and they get mad at me because of the implications of it. But if I ran a team, I would practice at 7 o'clock at night. And you could see why sports writers would hate that, because that would make every night would be a late night on deadline. But if you play at 7 o'clock at night, why shouldn't you practice at 7 o'clock at night? That's always been my theory on it. I mean, when I was studying for the SATs, they told me, this is a long time ago now, they said if you're sitting in a particular position for when you're studying for a test, then sit in that same position when you take the test. If you're chewing a particular flavor of gum while you're studying, then chew that gum while you're taking the test. Make everything to give yourself that chance to have that recall. And I've always thought that that would apply to athletes, and I've never really heard of any coach who had sort of the crazy idea to try that. I wonder if
do anything different. Yeah, it is interesting that they all stick to the formula.
They really do.
I think as far as the game day stuff, like I used to play guitar in a band, and not at a high level, but like practicing before you went on stage always made me better. I would like a little bit of that game day practice myself if I was an athlete. Oh. This show, I make great points at the bar after the show's done. I don't make any on the show, but it lubes me up for later in the night.
Well, I thought you were going to say that you just sit there and talk to yourself before you go on the air to get
Well, that too, yeah. But that's, you know, that's just one of my quirks.
Yeah, sure.
Anyway, you know, the season for Mike Johnston and his guys, it's been such an odd one because of the production or lack thereof. I went back to the last 31 games, going back, including the playoffs last year, Jonathan, and they haven't scored more than, combined with the other team involved, more than 8 goals in any of those games, and they're averaging total 4.29 goals per game for both teams.
Boy, that's
which
terrible.
Means it's like we're watching all these 2-1, 3-2 games every night, and the entertainment value therein, some nights it's good and some nights it's tough. I mean, you can watch a 1-0 game that's dramatically exciting.
That's true, yeah. There are
in Vancouver, maybe Fleury did stand on his head there where he made some keen saves. He did. But when it's that large of a sample size, then you get into questioning where the game is right now. And we had Mike Babcock come out this week, you know, one of the, if not the most prolific coach, he's certainly the highest paid one, say he would like the goals to be made bigger. So is this a universally held belief among the players that they want more goal scoring too? What are you hearing out there?
It's interesting. I would say it's not. I would say it's that I don't think that there's as much. I think there's more of a sentiment among fans and media that the game needs to be changed than there is among players. I think that's sort of natural, though. You know, you get a lot more. And also, I don't know that players even think about it that much, to be honest with you, because they're sort of in a forest for the trees situation.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Crosby said he's a traditionalist and he doesn't want to see the net bigger. But I mean, I'm I'm totally in favor of it myself. I mean,
well, he said that at first, and then he said, you know, I'm for whatever. I'm all for adding more goals, whatever. You know, he came around at the end.
Yeah, and I think, well, you know, when he'd really come around is the fact that if you added a couple inches on either side of the net, and like nobody would even notice, and it would just, all it would do is just add a couple of goals here and there. I mean, I don't know how much it would change, to be honest with you. I mean, I am in favor of it, but like. What you really want is not just more goals. You want to change the style of play and make it more exciting and make it more offensive. And I blame coaches more than I blame goalie equipment for that. And the game has become, and this isn't a new phenomenon, and I know I'm not breaking ground here, but it has become dramatically overcoached. You know, when you
but turn, that's what wins, right? I mean, they're only doing it because it wins. It works.
Absolutely. And the players are buying in. I mean, you see it with Crosby and Malkin.
Yep.
The players are buying into it. They're completely buying into it. You don't see there used to be guys who would sort of not buy into that theory. I always think of Alexei Kovalev. If you tried him and his Kovalev in his prime, if you tried to convince him to block shots, I don't think that would have gone so well. But today's scoring guys, they block shots. They do, you know, they come back deep in the defensive zone to help out, and they've bought into the, you know, what the coaches are selling, and it's a deep philosophical problem with the game. And I don't know. You know, I'd give it a try in terms of making the nets a little bit bigger, but I don't know that it would make that much of a difference just because there's that, you know, just safe defensive philosophy that coaches have because coaches can control that. I mean, I go back to Igor Larionov wrote, a big piece on that. I think it was for the Players Tribune about how coaches, first of all, a lot of coaches were not particularly skilled players when they played. So what
Dan Bylsma's of the world.
Yeah, and they don't understand that sort of mindset, and they can't control it. You can't coach skill. You can't coach execution. But what you can coach is defensive responsibility and positioning and structure. And so that's what they coach. And I really don't know the answer, and I don't mean to sound sort of like Rossi about it, because I know he's on that kick right now about how the game has become unwatchable, and I don't necessarily disagree with him. But
well, you look around the league at the highest scoring teams, and it's kind of surprising too. The Montreal Canadiens are one with Michael Therrien, and the Boston Bruins are two. You don't think of as an offensive juggernaut. Now they've had a lot of power play success. They got the best power play in the league. But what's making Montreal, Boston, Dallas, Washington? Why are those teams the highest scoring teams in the league?
That's a good question. I was looking at some line combinations, scoring by line combinations, and Montreal has like two of the top six in the league or something like that.
They turned Dale Weiss into a goal scorer.
Yeah, which is really odd. And I feel like they sort of, I mean, you look at that's a perfect example. Dallas doesn't necessarily fit this mold, neither does Washington, but Montreal does. I think Boston does. It's this concept of, you know, two or three lines with, you know, sort of similar lines. That, you know, a Plekanec and a Pacioretty, and these guys are sort of coming at you in waves so that you can attack the second and third D pairs. And I think that depth has a lot to do with Montreal scoring. Although I will say this, you know, I was going to say Montreal's approach is not superstar based, and it's not, but Max Pacioretty is a really underrated player.
Oh, he's good.
Yeah, and they're coming to town before our next show next week, so, I mean, it's sort of timely to mention that. That guy does not get the credit he deserves. He is a total stud, great goal scorer, and I'm going to be very happy that he will play for Team USA in the World Cup next summer.
Plekanec always gives Sid a hard time. I mean, he's a good defensive centerman, and, you know, they got good guy. Brendan Gallagher's a nuisance. He goes to the net and scores the dirty goals.
Yep, they got Thomas Fleischmann out of nowhere.
Yeah,
you know, and I think, and like you said, it's like you know, they go six or eight guys deep that can score. I think that's the model, and that's what we were talking about.
But the Penguins have that. That's the thing. Like, you look at the Penguins, you think they got it. They got Fair on a line. They got Bonino and Kunitz, who should be driving offense too. But you know, you look at the end of the night, it's 3-2. It's not 6-5.
Well, but in fairness, since Fair came back, and since, you know, Dupuis came back, and that bottom six is starting to look a little more formidable, you're talking three or four goals a game instead of two or three goals a game, right? I mean, the Buffalo game was four goals. The Toronto game was four goals. The Vancouver game was three goals. It's not setting the world on fire, but there has been that uptick in the last couple of games.
Fair enough. Yeah. And you do wonder with chemistry, and I brought this up to Rossi, and he didn't want to hear it. They do have a bunch of new players, and, you know, it's 10 games in. You know, you're 10% into the season, there is some mesh time that's got to come with it. And, you know, Dupuis coming back off injury, and the penalty kill's been good. The power play is bound to get better. So there, that is encouraging.
If that's the case, if that's true, then you're looking at a really good season that's about to happen here for the Penguins.
Yeah.
Because what they've done is they've established that sort of core principles of defending and getting good goaltending. If you add some...
And the PK. Yeah.
And the PK. And if you add some chemistry on top of that, then this is going to be a really, really good team. So, I mean, if that's something you can hang your head on if you're hoping for that.
What do you, when you look ahead to the trade deadline, this team's been so active there in years past. Everybody says they need to trade for a defenseman. Is that accurate? I mean, are we going to get back into... I mean, what do they need, if anything? If you're looking at this team and think they have this glaring need for X, what is it?
Well, I'll say this. As much as I've liked how Dumoulin and Lovejoy have played together, wouldn't you like to have them as a third pair instead of a second pair?
You would.
You know, wouldn't that be like, if you had them as a third pair, you'd be like, hey, this decor looks pretty good. I think Olli Maatta is an interesting sort of piece in all of this. Because, nobody's saying this in the organization, but a guy coming off of, you know, shoulder surgery, not to mention having a tumor. I mean, you know, God forbid.
Right.
They're breaking him in slowly. There's no question in my mind. They're trying to limit his ice time. They're trying to put him in, keep him out of the most difficult situations. And he's slowly but surely, he's responding to that. I mean, I know everybody hates it when I talk about plus minus, like I'm some kind of a relic from the past who still believes in plus
plus
minus.
Plus minus, where's the Corsi?
Yeah, I know, but it's just a good little snapshot. And I'm not saying it's a be-all, end-all, but he's a plus seven. Best on the team, last I checked. So, you know, he's sort of coming along. So if they continue to give him more and more ice time, more and more responsibility, then you put him up in a top four. And so now you're talking about, you know, obviously Letang is a top four guy. You don't need to necessarily get a top pair defenseman. You might need like a 4-5.
Like Dustin Byfuglien's name was out there early on, right? Like he was the one guy everybody was talking about. He was a pending free agent after the year. Does Winnipeg want to move him? He could give you a little physical punch in the blue line, but that's a big fish. You know, I don't know what he would take.
In a different era, I would give up a lot to get Dustin Byfuglien because I love guys like that. Mm-hmm. But in this era, I'm not sure it's worth if the juice is worth the squeeze there. I mean, you don't want defensemen who who take chances like he does and make plays like he does. And I just
does he run the point on a power play though? I mean,
he does, but it's more based on the fact that he's got a big shot. I actually think he's better in front of the net on the power play because he's done that when he's played forward. Like I don't know that he's the right style fit. What you need is a 2009 Sergei Gonchar. That's what the Penguins need to add. There you go. You need to get a time machine at the trade deadline.
Well, you joke about it. The Laird plan was to keep Gonchar on the team as the seventh defenseman and just play him on the power play. And everybody laughed at me. But here we are, and the power play stinks.
They still laugh at you, but for different reasons.
Agreed.
I think it's a smaller piece than Byfuglien right now. But you know what? That's sort of... That was not a joke about his size. I just mean in terms of an impact player. I don't know that they need to make mortgage, you know, that much on a guy. But it's really hard to say because you can't get away from the fact that you're speaking in at a point where they've won 7 of 8. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They lose 2 in a row, and you start thinking, I mean, they might need a little bigger piece than I thought on defense. So
March. Where it's a long way away.
That's right. And I think you need to really look over the next couple of months before you make a determination like that.
Speaking of the power play, they did score, and Crosby was in the middle of the ice for it. Does the fact that it was a 4-on-3, though, prevent you from getting a ton of excitement over how it looked? And, you know, Kessel was up top. It was all out of whack, but maybe that was a good thing.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the part where I'm not excited about that is that, in general, the power play still didn't look that good. You know, just on a game-by-game basis, when you watch it, do you think to yourself, boy, this is a dangerous group? I know I don't. Mm-hmm. So in general, I'd say, yeah, nothing to get excited about. But the cool part was the fact that it was, you know, Kessel and Malkin switched places, or maybe it was Letang, sort of cycled into different spots, and Crosby's... The idea of guys being in different spots... that's part of what makes the power play theoretically dangerous, is that different guys can dart into different holes. And make plays.
Player movement, if not puck movement.
Right. And that's the way it should. That's what they need to do, is have different guys in different spots. But, and I'll also tell you this. As, like, a second examination of that goal. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, that's a nice play. Kessel got it to the net, and Crosby got it in. You know, that happens all the time. But then you watch that a little closer. Crosby made a great play on that. To play it up to his stick, you know, to where he could get a shot on it. I mean, that's not... You see a play like that, and then you realize that, yeah, you know what? Crosby's not... he's not done.
Oh,
just
yeah,
yet.
He's good. We take him for granted. I mean, all the little things that he does do well.
Yeah.
He had a great stretch pass to Perron that caused the penalty.
That's right.
I mean, Perron got hooked. It should have been a penalty shot.
Yeah, I don't know if that's not a penalty shot. I don't know what it is. Yeah.
But that's still Sid vision and seeing him.
Absolutely.
And before that, it was he and Hornquist on a 2-on-1, and I think that one went off a post. I don't know. He threw it over to Hornquist on the rush.
Right, yeah, it went through the pads, and I don't know how. I'm still not sure exactly how that didn't go in. So I get what you sort of take from that is that, you know, when Crosby was talking to Mackey about this like the other day, and he said that the thing about his start that he doesn't like is he's inconsistent, and you sort of chalk that up as just athlete speak, which Crosby has like a PhD in athlete speak.
Oh yeah, he's great.
Yeah. But then you talk about plays like that, and then you think to yourself, you know what, maybe he's got a point. Like, maybe he isn't just sort of throwing out talking points. He's actually saying, you know, there are some times where I'm doing what I used to do. I just need to do it more often. And I think there's – from an if you try to put yourself in his headspace, like, that makes sense. He's thinking, like, yeah, you know, I'm not – it's not like I'm 38. I'm 28. I'm still, you know, capable of doing these things. I just need to do them more often.
A couple of notes I wanted to get your take on, Jonathan. Darren Dreger had his Dreger's report this week, and he was mentioning a few changes that could be coming. One is at the All-Star game, which has been a total snooze fest for decades now at this point, where they might go 3-on-3 as the format for the entire thing in some kind of weird they're still trying to figure out how they would do it, I guess, right? I mean, how would you pull it off? You'd have different groups of three, and how would you keep score? But are you all for that? Does anybody care? Is there anything they could do to salvage the All-Star game? I do love the 3-on-3 format.
I will say that when they do 3-on-3 contests, like in practices, the guys get into that. Like, they, you know, there's lots of internal competition.
Yeah, and that's what you want, some emotion from the players,
yeah.
You know,
so they,
some competitiveness.
That's right. They do have fun with that. So you could even, I mean, I picture it in my head, and I'm thinking you could even play it cross-rank. Like, you could play 3-on-3. You could have three games going on at once if you wanted to.
Oh, that'd be nuts.
Wouldn't that be wild? But I don't know that it makes so much of a difference. My stance on All-Star games has been, in anything other than baseball, because I think in a baseball baseball All-Star game situation, you can actually play a regular game for the most part. In any contact sport where there's going to be hitting and nobody wants to hit anybody in an exhibition game, and I completely understand that. Mm-hmm. So I've always been in favor of, like, you know, pick the teams – have the guys there, do the hardest shot, do the fastest skater contest, and then, you know, sign some autographs and go home. I don't know that the game itself is certainly not the main event of the festivities. Although, I mean, I guess you keep it around just for the sake of history.
That's right. If you go 3-on-3, it's basically 2 days of skills competitions. It's
right.
Not a game at all.
I'd watch it. A 3-on-3 tournament like that? I'd watch it. So,
or maybe put it into the night before, you know.
I don't know. I mean, is that what you're looking for, is to boost the TV ratings a little bit, make it a little more exciting? So, okay, I'll go for that.
Some people said play it outside. That's gotten some, you know, hits with the Winter Classic, but it's all gimmicks to try to get eyes on. And
yeah, I mean, to me, there's no way in sports based on contact, physical contact, you cannot have an exhibition game and an All-Star game that doesn't stink.
Well, speaking of that, we're back to actually on-ice stuff. There hadn't been a ton of fighting this year in the league, and the Penguins are certainly not built for that. We did have a little Kessel v. Derek Dorsett battle going on in the last game. That was a little fun.
Yeah.
I didn't know Kessel had that kind of feistiness in him there. He cross-checked him, basically.
He did. He gave him the business, yeah, no doubt.
What do you think of their physicality to this point, team-wide?
I think it's perfectly in keeping with the rest of the league. Which is to say that, like, 10 years ago, I'd say this team is not physical enough, not hard enough to get through a season. Now it's fine. You know where you really see that is Dumoulin. We're talking about how, you know, he's been impressive in the last couple of weeks. He's been impressive, with the fact that he's making really good first passes and that he's starting to get more comfortable with the puck on his stick. But let's not forget, he's like 6'4", 220.
Solid.
Yeah. Not that long ago, he would be expected to be knocking people around. He never knocks people around. So, and that's okay in 2015. And in, you know, in 1990, whatever, he would have been seen as a soft player.
So who needs Simon to pray, you know?
Well, I mean, the game's changing like that. I got to tell you this. In getting back to the, and I don't know that Rossi would ever admit to this, but in his screeds about the game being unwatchable, the fact that a lot of violence has been taken out of the game does make it less entertaining to me. I don't care what anybody says.
And he was crowing about Steelers Bengals, which was a violent game this week, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, everybody's going to be glued to that set.
Right. So I know that. Like, this is not the easiest question in the world. It's not like saying, well, they've ruined the game. It's not entertaining anymore because they took all the hitting and fighting out of the game. It's a bunch of panty wastes and these liberals these days. And, you know, back in my day, people used to hit each other with rocks. Okay, that's fine. But the reality is it's not that simple. There's concussion lawsuits. We know a lot more about brain damage than we ever knew back then. So it's not just as simple as saying, oh, they've screwed up our game. However, there are no hitters. Teams play no hitters all the time now. I mean, that Vancouver game, you know, you had the Kessel Dorsett confrontation, and you had some Fair and Dorsett and that kind of thing. But the total number of hits in that game, it was like 13-9, I think, or something like that.
Wow.
I mean, like, that's not much at all.
It's all stick on puck now. It's not, not body on body.
Yep, stick on puck, and it's sort of just like another brick in the wall as far as making the game less entertaining. I don't know the answer. I don't know that bringing back, line brawls is the is the way to make the game more entertaining. In fact, I suspect it's probably not. But
well, what you don't want is no fighting and no scoring. I mean, some combination of excitement somewhere, you know.
Well, look at a crowd. What gets a crowd out of its seat? Goals, big hits, fight every once in a while.
And the paid patriotism ads that they get paid to put on.
Yes, and money and fake flyovers or whatever. But, when you're talking about goals, hits, and fights, and those are the things that get people out of their seats, and over the course of the last, decade, all three are down, and then you wonder why the game isn't as entertaining, well, it's really not a mystery. You'd like to get those three things back up if you could.
Quick preview of tonight's and tomorrow night's games, Jonathan. The Oilers are 5-8. They lost Connor McDavid. The Calgary Flames are 4-9-1. And it's pretty surprising, actually, that they're struggling. But it is a back-to-back. It's on the road. It'd be kind of foolish to expect them to get 4 points out of this, or would it? Are you expecting a sweep of these two teams?
Yeah, that is tough. That's a tough – the Battle of Alberta swing. I wonder how many teams sweep it. When the road trip started with the Toronto plus the three Western Canadian games, we were talking about if they won 3 or 4, they'd call it a success. And I still probably agree with that. But that said, if you're going to Vegas, I'd say the Penguins will be favored in both those games. So – it's not unreasonable to expect they'll win them both. I'm even without McDavid, Edmonton is still one of the more exciting teams. Largely because they have at least two full lines of guys who are like legit scorers. Jordan Eberle coming back is not insignificant. He's legit. And Nugent Hopkins and Hall, and these guys are exciting players. So I'm actually I'm sort of looking forward to it. And their defense is not, like, it's not a strong point, so I keep waiting for one of these 5-4 games. I just know we're going to get one, and eventually. Has to happen, right? So
it's only been 31 games.
I know, so I'm thinking maybe tonight will be the night for that.
Great, like your optimism. What's been wrong with Calgary? They signed Dougie Hamilton, and they had a splash offseason, but not much so far.
My two thoughts are, I just saw them a little bit against the Flyers. I feel like the two things... is number one, their expectations were too high because they overachieved last year. Like that, I mean, like Yuri Hudler had like a,
yeah, he was huge.
He was way over his head. And, so they're going to, a little bit of regression to the mean, and also goaltending. Their goaltending's been really shaky. If there's one thing I meant to mention on the Edmonton thing, I wanted to ask your opinion on this real quickly. Do you feel like the Flyers have gotten a pass on that McDavid injury? Because, Manning, he turns McDavid's hip as they're going into the boards. he like grabs him by the hip and turns him a little bit, which is not something that normally happens when two guys are going into the boards. Like, I thought that was a little bit shady, to be honest with you.
Well, it is Philadelphia, and therefore you always look at it.
I'm not kidding. That's probably why I thought of it. Yeah, exactly. They have a higher standard than other teams.
It is, as you say, a contact sport. It's impossible to legislate it all away. So there's a degree of danger, and he was going hard to the net. Sometimes, you know, that's what you get when you
No, you're right. It just looked
play with fire a little bit.
It just looked a little weird to me, just a little bit different than you normally see.
Great job as always, Jonathan. Look forward to this every week, Fridays from 1 to 2. We'll have it up on the podcast page, and enjoy your weekend. Late night affairs.
Yeah, that'll be fun. You too.
All right, Jonathan Bomboli, Wilkes-Barre, and back this week. And breaking the Derek Pouliot public drunkenness news, news that would never be associated with Kevin Gorman or the Kevin Gorman Show, that's coming up next. He's talking student-athletes, scholastics, and getting into the stretch run, the highway to Heinz, the playoffs starting, all coming up here on Trib Live Radio.
Pittsburgh's college hockey team, the Robert Morris Colonials, take to the 84 Lumber Arena ice at the RMU Island Sports Center on Neville Island this season as defending Atlantic Hockey Conference champions. Season, group, and individual game tickets are on sale now. New ticket prices for the 2015-16 season are in effect and offer many great opportunities for Colonial fans to come out and support their favorite team. Season tickets start at just $120 for 15 games. Individual tickets start at just $10 if you buy in advance and $12 day of game. There are also special discounts for kids, seniors, and military, plus lots of promotional giveaways. For more information or to buy, visit rmutickets.com or call the RMU ticket office at 412-397-4949.